Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Mindfulness in Action with a book by the same name. Today is March 24th, 2016, I think.
Correct.
And today we are doing Chapter 19, which is called Galaxies of Stars, Grains of Sand. So before that, I'd like to ask you, who was here last week? Oh, good number, okay. So Emily and I were not here, as you know, and I'd like to say just a little bit about where we were. We were at the Media Lab at MIT, an event called Celebrating Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky, among other things, is known as certainly one of the founders of what's called artificial intelligence studies. He was much more than that. He was my first mentor, which is why I went. It was called Celebrating Marvin Minsky. He died, by the way, in January. And he was like our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, in that he influenced, I don't know, thousands of people, perhaps. He taught cognitive and perceptual psychology or science, robotics, engineering, art, music, and he was a brilliant pianist. And the people who were influenced by him include academics, inventors, government officials, military people, medical people, lawyers, and all kinds of people all over the place. He had absolutely tremendous influence. And he's also like Chogyam Trungpa in that he gave everything away. As soon as there was a possibility that someone else could do something, he said, okay, you do it. I don't want to hang on to anything. And he was constantly creating new phenomena, inventions, ideas, machines, and leadership, and handing all of those things away. So it was actually a transformative experience for the two of us to attend this event. His approach to artificial intelligence was always towards understanding mind, and the way he understood mind always worked towards no self throughout his career. Even when he was building devices, he never lost that view. He always thought mind has complexities. The complexities are beyond our awareness, and mind is beyond whatever idea we have of self. So we're on very familiar ground. So I cannot tell you about this simply because he went there and it wouldn't do too much good. It is online. I just have one little story to tell, and it's a brief story. And this was told by a man, there were many speakers, and this was a man by the name of Yoshiaki Shirai. And he was in the AI lab in the 1970s, studying with Marvin. He got a doctorate there, and then he went back to Japan, and after a while, he was director of an important artificial intelligence laboratory there. He got up and he said, well, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the difference between Japanese and American humor. And this is the story he told. When he came there, he was, of course, very grateful. He listened all the time. His attention never wavered. And he didn't have much to say. So Marvin took note of this and decided to give him a non-Japanese experience. And Marvin came up to him and said, "Here is your assignment. Once a week, you have to come up to me in my office and say, 'You're wrong, Marvin.'" Marvin always used brilliant dialectic, and that could lead to Marvin being wrong, or Shirai being wrong, or something totally new emerging. You couldn't tell, but something would happen because of that kind of creative interaction. Marvin, you're wrong, Marvin. So this, of course, is what we need here. If you believe your teachers, that would be terrible. So I'm hoping that everyone will step up and say what's on their mind and not worry too much whether you're right or wrong, because that's never the point. So thank you for that. So today's chapter is called Galaxies of Stars, Grains of Sand. Guess what it's about?
All five Gandhas.
Five Gandhas.
That's the first one.
You recognize them, though.
It's
really
exciting. They're like this in the book that we read on the Gandhas.
Yeah,
the Avatar. Very much like that. That ended with four soldiers on a back and a camel. And I can't remember what chapter it was.
You can go to both. Do you have pictures of Gandhas?
Well, show the cover at least.
Oh, Society of Mind.
This book is called The Society of Mind.
Uh-huh.
Society of Mind means that there's no one thing that could be called self. Uh-huh. That's what the title is.
It's by Marvin Minsky.
And it's by Marvin Minsky, yes. Mm-hmm. Later he wrote a book on emotions.
Yeah. When was that written?
This one was written some time ago. Yeah. 85, apparently. The one on emotions is much more recent. So I thought I'd just start off this kind of discussion very briefly. We all believe that human minds contain those special entities we call selves. But no one agrees about what they are. Here are some of the things people say about the self. Self is the part of mind that's really me. Or rather, it's the part of me, that is, part of my mind that actually does the thinking and wanting and deciding and enjoying and suffering. It's the part that's most important to me, because it's that which stays the same through all experience, the identity which ties everything together. And whether you can treat it scientifically or not, I know it's there, because it's me. Perhaps it's the sort of thing that science can't explain, and that would be a big challenge if Minsky would not ask the question. Even if our old ideas about the mind are wrong, we can learn a lot by trying to understand why we believe them. Instead of asking what ourselves, we can ask instead what are our ideas about selves. And then we can ask, what psychological function do these ideas serve? When we do this, this shows us that we do not have one such idea, but many. And he goes on throughout the whole book, from many selves to no self being more authentic or real than any other, and finally to authenticity being beyond any idea or opinion about self. There's a whole lot of it throughout the whole book. So I think this class already has the wisdom to point out and discuss the five skandhas. We don't really need any more information. And in any case, it's in the text. All you have to do is find it. So I'd like to start out just by reading one little bit. Right at the beginning. One of our greatest fears is the fear of losing our identity, ourselves. We may associate the loss of self with mental instability or with dying and our fear of death. However, being less self-centered and discovering a more open state of mind, one that isn't so rigidly defined, could be viewed as a very positive and sane development. On a very mundane level, we may experience a momentary, unexpected gap in our storyline or thought process. We might consider this a moment of freedom, but our usual response is to panic and try to cover up the fact that we've lost the thread. Our panic takes the form of bewilderment and confusion, which enables us to play deaf and dumb, ignoring what we've seen. I'm sure you've heard this many times before. And one other thing I wanted to mention here. Okay, at bottom of page 130, just so we keep it in mind, the skandha is not a developmental history like since we were born. It's instantaneous. There are a number of aspects or stages in the development of this mistaken sense of self or ego. This development does not take place over time like a baby growing up into an adult. We create all the complications almost simultaneously all the time. So everything we need to know is here, right? Right in this book. And we don't need really a lot of further information. So I thought maybe we could have five volunteers.
Skanda one, two, three, four, five.
Oh. And we have a first skanda volunteer. You can start by just reading. Can we have a volunteer for first skanda, please? Thank you.
We have four.
We have five then. And then maybe a take home at the end.
We're going to take home a skanda?
What's takeaway, right? What is John Hockenberry's show called at 10 o'clock in the morning?
Takeaway,
right. Okay, so this is a takeaway at the end. And John Hockenberry, who was a friend of Marvin, was the MC at what we saw, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
It's
great.
Incredible in his wheelchair.
So do you want me to find? I found where the first skanda is.
You found the first skanda. Please tell us. Read us. Whatever.
The first stage in ego's development is latching onto form, trying to create a home in our confusion and bewilderment. On page 136.
Do you want to read more or elaborate more?
Well, it goes to the next sentence and jumps to the next. The whole medicine.
Sure, whatever's worthwhile to pull out for the first skanda.
So, I mean, that metaphor, that makes sense. One of the other metaphors that I can suggest to me, if you're in your bedroom in the dark, the electricity doesn't work, then you can sort of stumble around and you try to figure out where things are by feeling and getting a sense of what
comes next.
So that's
look here. Look on page 131. Yeah, 131.
Someone else want to say something about the first sconce before we go on?
And I thought it started around 131. Page 131.
For both.
It's the second paragraph in the middle of the page. So who we are and what we are is uncertain. We think we exist. We think our name is so-and-so. We think we have a soul or ego of some kind. But really, we have no idea how and why and what is exactly the case. Logically, we may be able to justify our existence in detail, but experientially, we are much more uncertain. This me, this seeming experiencer, seems to be experiencing its me-ness, this-ness. Something seems to be happening here. Something is cooking, as they say. This uncertainty and our attempts to secure ourselves in response to it make up the first aspect or layer of ego, which is a sense of form. The creation of form here is like a blue cheese that is constantly fermenting, growing one mold on top of another all the time, because you don't really exist in the way that you think you do. You are constantly trying to secure your existence. You are like that blue cheese, which tries to maintain itself by continually growing more mold until the mold consumes the cheese, which dissolves into nothingness, a pile of moldy dust.
How great!
Oh, apple
pie. We are the cheese.
Any questions?
Yes.
The thing that always surprises me when I hear, the concept of skanda being recreated instantaneously all the time. And there seems to be a continuity there. It was, how would you explain it in the sense that I always thought implicit in it was it's a total recreation. That is, it's a random recreation, which, defies our concept of organization. So I don't quite understand, at least a little bit. Could you help me understand even a little more this notion of recreation instantaneously, everything?
Well, it is created every instant, and the point usually made is that it's happening so fast it's like a film, a video, or where the frames are going by fast enough so that it gives the appearance of continuity. It's one way to look at it. But each time it's different. It never works. So an instant later needs something different.
So you could explain death the same way, that somehow that instantaneous recreation is somehow destroyed.
Yeah.
And you don't get a recreation. It seems like the wrong concept, the wrong way to say it.
You want to say something?
Well, so if we're looking at a film strip and there are a bunch of still images in each strip, each image, they're just by themselves. But, in this process of going, it's going much faster than we're keeping track of. So we see a continuity. And also, we are not, because we have all these skandhas taking place simultaneously, the fifth skanda, which is what we come up with this great idea, I exist, right? That's the one called consciousness. That's what basically creates this notion of seamlessness. I mean, it's saying this is a story and this is the story. It's taking all these disparate, choppy kind of fragments and constantly arranging them.
I think also, and I may be wrong in what I think I hear you saying, Harry Bob, is that.
Exactly! That's the point!
That death and birth are happening like over and over and over and over and over again. Like in an instant. Like everything is being birthed, and then dying continually. And what, when they're writing this out about first form, then feeling, then perception, you know, all of that, that it is, it's slow-mowing everything so that we can go grasp, okay, the process of birth to death, birth to death, birth to death, over and over again.
I think another piece, that idea that it seems continuous, is sort of like, they do these studies now where, like, you can leave out parts of, images, and when people look, their brains see the whole thing, because their brains are set up to make sense of the world, like filling in gaps.
Mm. Exactly.
And so that's what our brains do, like that what I was 10 seconds ago isn't the same as now. Well, my brain says, no, all the gaps, it's all smooth, it's all nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to think about, like, I'm a new person now, no. I'm going to smooth it. And my brain does that for me.
Yeah, I think, by analogy to physics, the physical world, that actually seems very plausible in that, there's almost no actual physical matter. There's a lot of stuff moving very, very fast. And the idea that but the net effect is solidity. And so the idea that the mind and, mental constructs work the same way, just that seems plausible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the Buddha and Robert Minsky weren't the only people to discover themselves. Another person who did is Gurdjieff, and Michael could tell you quite a bit about that. It's an interesting story, not today, for lack of time, but at some point. He should definitely do it.
Treading on dangerous ground.
He should definitely do it at the right time. It's a very fascinating story, and he's going to tell you.
There's a book that was the first book he wrote, which is called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. There's a section called The Terror of the Situation, which is all based on the notion of somebody in charge, holding the reins of this wagon, holding the horse, and actually driving, as it were. And once you begin to examine who this person seems to think they are, you just discover that they're a composite of hundreds of notions of self, and none of which have any real, true reality at all. But because of this habit of being somebody, we insist that there's somebody there. So just one more quickie in terms of death, because that was an issue you had about death. In the Tibetan teachings, when we die, unless we're trained in recognizing what's going on, we just pass out by going to sleep. And when we wake up, as it were, we actually encounter what leads to just a pursuit of, we're here and following our path, following being who we are, doing our stuff, following our pattern. So they suggest that the suggestion is that unless we do the training, the meditation training, and the actual study and practice, that we will only endlessly recycle that way.
He's up to Scondus with that.
Scondus? We've got to go on.
Well, that's what they are. The patterns.
Patterns. Okay, so are we ready? If you were to describe what goes on in a nuclear explosion, it would take you a long time to describe it, right? Even though it happens in picoseconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it's happening faster than we can talk about it. So, we have a volunteer for the second Skanda.
Who's going to volunteer? Okay, thank you.
Page 133, the second stage is feeling, or we could call it a sense of touch. We try to feel out or reach out to touch to determine who is on our side and who is against us. And if you are in your bedroom in the dark and the electricity isn't working in your house, you try to find your way out of the room by using your hands to touch the walls and things around you. You feel your way out of the room as though you were a blind person. And you're feeling your way in the dark, you're trying to avoid running into things, and you want to find a door. Sort of goes on and on. So there might be a big column or something you can bump into. You want to avoid tripping over anything, and you might want to find your way to the bathroom, might want to reach the closest window. So there's a quality of feeling out whether things are for you or against you, good or bad. This primitive sense of feeling your way around in the dark is like ego's primitive attempt to feel out the textures of life. Altogether, this non-entity is called me, myself, and I is trying to create a bag or container for itself. It is trying to survey and secure its territory.
That makes me think of the image of feelers. I just made a connection there with like a worm or whatever, the caterpillars, the insects. They have these feelers, so they're feeling out their world. And it's funny, I just never thought of that word.
Yeah.
That actually helps, I think, that explained a lot more about the second skandha. We encountered this when we were studying the Glimpses of the Dharma book. No, we didn't read.
Yeah.
So, you know, this actually has an almost animal kind of quality in terms of an actual anatomical sensation of what actually happens in terms of being blind and not having any other mode of perception other than just feeling and getting a sense of the field. So, you know, instinctively this goes on all the time. We do it all the time.
For or against.
Well, that's the meaning for the next.
That comes later. So
feeling is for or against or ignorance. So we already have an attitude before we even know what the world is all about. That's the point he made. It is attitude, and it could.
Which one is attitude? Number two.
Feeling.
Two.
Yeah. And then is it?
I know that they're all dealing with the sense of duality, but it feels like this one is the place where you really divide into that more strongly.
Each one's stronger. Yeah.
It gets stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
But here you've already decided that you like what's going on and you don't. You're felting towards friendship or enmity or pure avoidance before you even know what's out there.
So I think I'm a little confused. So the word feeling has two related but different meanings in English.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's like I'm feeling the book and I'm feeling confused.
Mm-hmm.
And they're related, but they're not the same.
Yeah, but, yeah, maybe neither of them is what's going on here. I have a problem with the word.
Okay. So
because it's not about touch and sensation.
Okay.
Nor is it about emotion, which is another way, way we loosely use the word. Mm-hmm. I think attitude works, but...
It's using that as a metaphor. I mean, it says we try to feel out or reach out to touch to determine who is on our side and who is against us.
Yeah.
And that he was just using this as a metaphor.
But we're looking for some kind of support. This is it's support. It's what, you know, this is a very primitive kind of sense of support. Babies are constantly looking for where they can go and stop. You know, they're just pushing out. Oh, can't go anymore.
That our feeling helps prop up the ego.
Yeah.
So is attitude more like I'm being thrown by the word.
What all the Tibetan books say about feeling is that it's feeling for or against, or it is neutral. Okay, it really gives you three things, not a range of emotions and quality, just three things.
I think the confusion is understandable, because I believe that that paragraph actually starts with one sense of the word feeling and actually shifts halfway through. I don't think that's deliberate, but I think that where the paragraph ends, I believe, is what the intended meaning is. A sort of, do I like it, do I not like it, or do I not care? But it starts with the sensory meaning of the English word feeling.
I agree with that.
So it makes me think of this experience I had when I was in New York a few weeks ago at the Whitney Museum of Art. On this one floor, you go up to this floor, and it's vast. And New York, it's crowded, right? But it's huge, the whole length of the museum. A wall of windows on the riverside, the Hudson River, and the other end of the building, another wall of windows. And you walk in there, and it's just huge open space. And then you hear this kind of screaming and clanging. And I'm looking around for a person, because it felt like someone was in the room. But all you have is a feeling of relating to the space. And your mind is like, you could feel your mind churning. What is this? It's empty. This is a museum. Where is stuff? And there's this noise, and it's coming out of where? I can't find it. Looking around everywhere, seems like there's a person. And literally, I couldn't figure it out until I went over to the wall and read the inscription, which was Sing Sing Prison was up the river, and these are sounds of a prison experience of people in these cells, like 6 by 9 feet, and what it's like to be in prison compared to the spaciousness of, rich people getting to go to a museum and hanging out in this open space. For me, that was pure feeling. Like, you can't figure out what's happening. It's just a feeling. And then you get more information and then you go to the next step, I guess.
I was about to say that just leads you so much into the next ganda.
Yeah.
Like, you can't help it, because immediately that sense of disparity is even stronger because of feeling immediately goes into perception.
So did you get a feeling of life or dislike?
Mostly it was confusion. The feeling of light was the space. You could feel, you looked at this enormous space with light in either end, and it was gorgeous. And then at the same time, you're hearing this kind of dissonance and, the clanging of metal doors and things, and what that must sound like. It was so loud.
So several things are going on, probably in sequence. You like the space.
Yeah.
You don't like the sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then
you don't know.
You don't know. You're ignorant. You have no idea what's going on.
Well, there's that discomfort.
Discomfort. Yeah.
And the discomfort is primarily confusion. That's got set off in the first gong.
Which is exactly.
Because
right.
There's nothing stable. Everything is constantly collapsing and reforming. And there's nothing to hang on to, so we're looking for some sense of continuity, some sense of something to basically affirm. And so you're in that state of not being able to do that, and that's why we have to go to the next ganda to elaborate further. Mm.
Yeah, what's the next one?
Wow, the next one. How about someone on this side of the room? Time to three. Mm-hmm.
The next aspect of this project is impulse. Having developed some rough relationship or connection with the phenomenal world, and knowing which textures are smooth, which are rough, and which are irrelevant, we have reactions to those things on a very primitive level. We have the impulse to respond to situations. whatever message seems to be coming to us, we want to latch onto that information and secure it as a reinforcement for ourselves. Our impulsive response to situations is to draw them in, push them away, or ignore them. Whatever appears, we are ready to leap forward, leap back, or stand our ground.
In the next paragraph.
Okay, so that's really, all right. I was actually thinking that seems to be still a restatement of the previous one. Having developed a rough sense of form and some feeling for our world, and having developed an impulse to respond or crudely communicate, now we reach a stage where we manage to put our feelings into categories.
Yeah.
If you stayed in that dark house groping around for a long enough time, you would begin to form an idea of what was in the space. You know there's a staircase down over there, so you won't go in that direction. There's a stone column in front of you, so you have to be careful not to bump into it. The window is in one direction, food is in the kitchens over there somewhere else, it's an extended metaphor, and the bathroom is down the hall. So although we are basically completely blind, we still develop some sense of direction, almost as an animal instinct. That very basic sense of categorizing is the beginning of concept, which is the next stage in developing a solid sense of self. It is not the product of wisdom, it is just labeling and naming things, quite stupidly.
Basically, I think we went on.
Yeah, we shifted
it
to the fourth.
It was so brief that that's fine.
So where was the boundary of the third? Because it seems that the first paragraph was still describing
reactivity.
The second.
Reactivity, were you talking about reactivity?
The impulse to react.
And many of us, I mean, in my own case at least, you get so used to establishing your identity as a reactor. The reactor is actually an identity as well. So each of these has kind of like a little segment of identity.
Mm.
And so reactor is, just sort of impulsively reacting, and one can easily identify with that as a kind of initial sense of continuity or a further sense of continuity. We've already got the feeling because the first gun is really choppy and, it's fragmentary. So we're trying to create continuity.
So it was Emily's going to read, what's going on here as a way to put things into categories.
Give me something to hang on to here.
Right.
I can't figure this out.
Yes,
the category would be the fourth. The third is just getting what's that? Stability, right.
Keep in mind that the whole process is virtually instantaneous. So if we're talking about 10 seconds of your experience, then the whole thing is there are multiple scanned processes going on.
Right.
Not just one.
Yeah. I realize I have a sort of basic problem with the fact that we're that in the course of a chapter we're talking about them and they occur one after the other, and it seems that the simultaneity is so central. I mean, you don't say, okay, today I'm only going to do Skanda 4 and tomorrow we'll do Skanda 3.
Okay,
So sort of like what the way that it's presented sequentially, is that meant to be the way that it unfolds within us, or is it a way of exploring the concept?
Well, first of all, to describe it, we have to take a lot more time than when it happens, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so
maybe the problem is that just that they're described as 1 through 5, and as if that's a progressive.
It is progressive, even if it takes microseconds. But the important thing is that what's going on is underground, and we don't know it. We don't know how our mind comes up with something until it does. The skanda is a discussion of something that's invisible. Our mind doesn't know how our mind knows. Okay, that's the key point, which is made a dozen times in this book too. Also, we don't know how we know. We don't know how we arrive at where we arrive at. We're constantly, something happens in the mind, but the mind doesn't tell itself, all sorts of things happened on the retina, all sorts of things happened on the optic nerve, all sorts of things happened in the
frontal lobes, we don't get to see how our mind works. We just get to see the result of it. Now, whether some kind of insight can start to back us up a bit, I'm not quite sure, but we're seeing the fruition of it only. Or we may get some sense that it goes through these stages if we contemplate enough. But that is always sort of a retrospective analysis. The mind is going. We don't know how it goes. We don't know what produces the next one. What triggers it? What comes up from memory? What comes up from sensory neurons? Whatever. And today I feel like talking scientifically a bit, but you don't have to.
I wonder why. I just want you to know what time it is.
I think what you're just pointing out is that it happens over and over and over and over and over again. And as Michael said, so quickly that we haven't got a clue that that's what we're doing, that we're always fundamentally on some level taking our temperature, assessing, solidifying, etc.
Yeah, our experience in the world is the combination of all five.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. at any given moment.
And this is actually simultaneous,
right,
rather than sequential.
Yeah.
I mean, the sequentiality is described for us in order to understand how this could be constituted, like looking at the structure of the situation, but the actual experience is simultaneous.
Simultaneous from our experience.
Yeah.
I don't think it's simultaneous from instrumentation or something like that. It does take some time, but we are not privy to how our mind works. It's got a lot of stuff in it, and it's not visible to us.
I think the image I have is not as much telecast, it's extremely interweaved. Seven of scan of three, and then go back to scan of one and two.
I'm sure they're overlapping.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's not a simplistic thing. You can only describe it as such.
The challenge I have with the skandhas is that a lot of the things that we talk about, you can experience, but it's something that we're talking about, but you kind of have to accept it on blind faith.
Mm.
And how do you investigate those if it's happening so fast, simultaneously?
Is it blind faith, or is there some eventual understanding that the mind is continually churning up faster than we can be aware of it, and that we aren't aware of it, but we get a sense that it's happening,
well,
and we have the evidence of it.
But I think that this was determined by people practicing meditation. I mean, it's fairly easy to go into the fourth skandha, for instance, and the fifth skandha, and actually understand how those work. The fourth skandha, which is this huge implementation of mind that has this categorization process, the pigeonholes, and it has all these different qualities. When you read the various qualities, they're both positive and negative, virtuous and unvirtuous. They're not all bad. I mean, we're talking about just the constituencies of mind. And we can actually investigate these things. We can actually investigate further as we train in the practice. We can actually train further and go into the third skandha and actually understand how our discernment works, how we actually say yes or no, and how we actually work with desire, which is also associated with that skandha. And then we can go into feeling, and just basic feeling and prejudice, which is basically, you could say, prejudice, as Michael said, attitude. You begin to realize, well, attitude is something one can change. You know, it's not something that you just have to put up with, right? And then from there, we can actually go into that first skandha. The first skandha requires us to get very familiar with ourselves, I think, and familiar with how things start. We have to watch where thoughts come from. We actually have to see how moods form, how moments shape,
And we can only do that by continuing to investigate where our thoughts arise, where they dwell, where they cease. Do they have any texture? Where do we get the notion that there is a texture? Why do we sense them as having a texture or, you know, characteristic that puts us in a frame of mind? So all of this is actually available to us in the act of the process of meditation. It's not going to happen in a half an hour sit, but, you know, this is something that is developed. And this is how what seems to be a theory, or at least an explanation or a suggestion for how the mind works, was done by people who actually investigated these things. It was not something that just somebody came up with and then got a bunch of monks to agree with them about it, you know. Or the Buddha just saying, this is how it is, take it or leave it, and everybody goes, okay. You know, it actually was done very painstakingly through the practice of meditation.
I think that's a good description, and particularly you said that the fourth skandha is accessible if we work on it, and the fourth skandha, in fact, is an awful amount of mental work. Mm-hmm. We put a tremendous amount of effort into it continuously, and if we learn to relax that, our mind has more energy and clarity. I think that's something we can start to experience. And that's the first step in unwinding the thing.
Do you want to say more what the fourth skandha is? Or do we really define that?
The fourth skandha, it brings in more than just a bunch of notions. It brings in an entire situation. Before it can really be conscious, you need a lot more scenario, a lot more of context. This is what it's about. This is the ongoing argument I have with so-and-so, or this is how I feel about my lover, or whatever the context is. It's been working for quite some time. There's a big hunk of background there, and we arrange a lot of furniture in our mind. Heavy moving of furniture is what the fourth skandha is. Effort, mental effort, that we could relax a bit and simplify.
What's the furniture?
All the ideas and context, and by the time we become conscious of it, we already have a story. It's not that consciousness is
we're believing it. We're
buying
in.
Yeah, a lot of stuff goes on there. And traditionally, there's said to be 52. The word is samskara, and there's said to be 51 of them. And you could actually go and read a list of them, and there are all kinds of mental operations and bringing in relevant things into the fantasy that's being cooked up.
So, would you say that the recreation thing comes into play, like some people were talking about the overlapping and the initialies and everything occurring simultaneously? Well, in this category of becoming aware of categories, give approximation. So, the recreation or the creation out of some unfoundedness keeps occurring because it has to in the sense that all the perfect duplication of whatever it's trying to pattern is not there. You know, let's say it's in the dark and they don't quite know what is out there. So they get some kind of a approximation of a shape, let's say, and then the earlier part just recreate a feeling.
Well, it's constant work to create the story of me. Over and over and over again, continuously. The story of me is being churned up.
Okay, can I ask one more thing about this instantaneous use, that word to me, you know, it's an amazing word. But let's take the speed of life. Are you talking about the instrumentation and, you know, this great scientist who postulated it was just a piece of a quanta, you know, piece of a wave. Okay, then, but they couldn't, well, it might have occurred after the speed of light was determined. And, but they had the notion that there was a particle and it could be, you know, measured. But nobody could measure it. They had to have this, you know, tool between mountains bouncing off.
Well, you're giving the history of scientific development, okay, which is not quite what this is.
Well, you're talking so hard about a model and that it can be somehow verified ultimately. And you mentioned the word instrumentation.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, well, what's it like in my world? And that is, you can have a model like that.
Yeah, but it's not about history. Okay, that's the fundamental point.
Well, more importantly, we're talking about the content of mind here. This is why it's so vast. The fourth skanda is enormous because it actually, we're dealing with what consists of, what are the constituencies, the contents of mind. Okay, we're talking about behavior patterns, we're talking about factors, intelligence, elements of intelligence, we're talking about mental processes, we're talking about how we go from point A to point Z or any other points in the circuit. We're talking about the circuitry, and this is a very highly elaborate kind of thing, and it's the most complex of any of the skandhas because it's so vast. If we just read the number of elements that we look at, we talk about 51, but I mean, if you go in to look at the 51 factors that are going into this, they in themselves have further kind of elaborations and definitions. So we're talking about the contents of mind. It's the simplest way of putting it. Okay? We're not talking about trying to find some physical property related to, you know, physics that would explain how this works. This is something else. So I think it's these people who came to this understanding through direct insight were able to actually just see the mental content. And that's how the whole notion of the skandhas was developed.
We can do that.
We can. We can. And in fact, we have to, I think, we have to determine these. We can't just go along with it and say, gee, this is a great idea, or I don't like it, you know, it doesn't agree with me. We need to investigate to see whether this is true.
It feels, to another metaphor, is that the fourth skandha is really you're drawing a bunch of maps and diagrams.
All kinds of stuff, yeah. In particular, we have a whole memory of ideas about me that have been stuffed there waiting to come up.
Yeah. So really the idea of the past is much more in play in that fourth skandha?
There's certainly the use of memory, okay? Yeah. All the memories about me. So.
And they're reinforcing. They're going to go back and reinforce the earlier skandhas as well.
Right.
They're informing. Everything's informing the other skandhas. They're all. This is in the informing process, which is a very interesting term itself, because we also use that term formation.
We should go on to the fifth skandha.
Yeah.
Pardon me for going back to science, but I'm just fascinated that it appears that the process of recalling a memory actually, rewrites it and edits it slightly.
That's part of the kind of theory.
That's enough way where modern neuroscience actually matches up with some of the problems.
That's a good point. Yeah, we rework the memory so that when a memory comes up, then what we have after that is the memory of the memory. It's a lot of cut chewing.
And there's always some alteration. It's never exactly the same.
Yep.
The only memories that are the same are the ones that are never seen because they're held down, and, you know, they're repressed or suppressed.
And so they're not being altered by investigation.
Mm-hmm. So is the goal to be like someone with dementia that literally is disconnected from 1 second
to the next? I sure hope not.
They're really in the moment.
Dementia and life. Yeah.
We're working for liberation, not the insanity.
You're really not talking about dementia. You're just talking about you're talking about, I mean, it probably would not, a lot of that stuff would not apply to people who are psychotic, certain people.
Well, it applies to everyone, but if you're out of control, you're going to be in a mess. Okay? There's no attempt to make people psychotic here. The whole process of meditation makes us sane. No, it's opposite. Okay, so if you're going to go insane, then you aren't meditating.
Well, I'm talking about people who are, but I mean, this is totally applies to everybody.
We all have minds, okay? We all have minds, but there are lots of ways we can.
They don't have a sense of identity anymore, so they don't need to do this. They're already there. They may need to.
No, they're not there. They're crazy.
They're not there. They aren't. And we're talking about.
They have sconces out of control.
We're talking about a working with a sense of wholeness. Jim, you have something?
Yes. Oh, it's the fourth moment when this is short circuited. In other words, you're not taking something there and connecting it to your storehouse of memories and making a judgment and pigeonholing it. And
how about you're not buying it? You're not believing it. Okay, it's not that you.
So for that brief moment, that's maybe something longer.
It can short circuit it. I think if you're checking into the fourth moment, you are actually going beneath the root of thought. And the root of thinking is precisely what we're talking about here with the skandhas. Mm-hmm. So we're undercutting. If you're in the fourth moment, it's beyond that. It's unconditioned. We are talking about all the elements that cause conditioning.
So there's no skandhas in the fourth moment.
Absolutely.
I'm going there.
Yeah, for you. Okay. How about the fifth skandha?
Hold down.
Someone want to do the fifth skandha?
I think the chapter is deliberately written to have the overlap. I was reading a couple of pages. I think it's designed so that you can't actually draw boundaries exactly between the skandhas.
Yeah.
In the middle of 135, it does start off the last process of what's known as consciousness.
Yeah, okay. You want to read that?
Or someone else can. Okay. This is seemingly far from the fundamental bewilderment. Here, consciousness develops in a sense of totality and emotionality. We learn how to love and hate the whole process of our lives. Those stairs are terrible. I hate them. And the column is bad, too. I don't like it because it might cause me to break my nose or bang my head and see stars. And that bathroom is good. It gives me relief. Food is fantastic. It will feed me, sustain me. So we begin to not just label things, but to enshrine them as very good or very bad for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of hits the point, doesn't it? It's all about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although we possess all these faculties, our nose, our eyes, our ears, our body, our tongue, our mouth, and our brain and our heart, so basically we're not using them to see the world in a way that is clear, sharp, or unbiased. We are still playing blind, deaf, and dumb because we're still working with the story of me. Okay, the take home is the last paragraph. The practice of meditation provides a way to work with this complicated experience of mind. In meditation, our attitude is not to label the self or ego as a villain or an evil force that needs to be destroyed. It is our stepping stone. The only material we have to work with is our experience of ourselves, so it is our starting point. From this point of view, we should celebrate that we have ego, therefore we have some hope of discovering sanity.
But I'm
no way.
Okay. And I feel like I haven't addressed you about psychotic people who are certainly not liberated. And what Ed says, we are developing over time the stability of mind to liberate ourselves. And people who are in a continual state of chasing things with no hope of ever pulling the head up are in a bad state. Okay.
Yeah, that's sort of being a gaslight. I guess what I was bringing up is that it's written for, I think, and you know more about this than I do, so.
Not necessarily.
But it's assuming a certain type of people, a certain mental state. I don't think it's written for someone who truly has dementia and already is just living in the moment. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not that everyone that's using it is fine.
Well, okay, but who is it written for? There's a specific answer. Who is it written for?
Who?
Yeah.
Like most neurotic people who have strong egos and they're trying to kind of read, trying to get out of that.
This is written for people who are willing to come and sit on a cushion.
Whatever kind of mind they bring to the cushion.
I get what you're saying because I'm not demented, I don't think. but I do have a head injury. And I got very confused because I am that person that you described that lives in the moment.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't know, since I banged my head, I don't know who I am anymore. And so everything is new and foreign and lost. So I get what you're saying about how this is, you know, sort of written for everybody else. It's not written for those of us that, and I'm not saying it's not written for that, but it's more of a challenge for those of us that maybe aren't all there to get,
right?
Because it describes my life.
I'm a psychologist, so I was thinking about a lot of different people I've worked for and worked with. So, yeah, I mean, I think it really makes sense for those of us and all of us when we're overly controlled and overly defining ourselves, but probably for anyone when we're not, when we're kind of. I'm at a loss of words, but anyway. Yeah.
When we're ready to come here, which you are, you come here and you sit in a chair and you stay here, okay? So this is for you.
I think I've worked with a lot of psychotic and demented people too, and I certainly don't see them like you. I mean, see people open up the laundry bin, Arthur, are you in there, Arthur? And, you know, people that take their shoe and answer the telephone, like, hello, hello? I can see them as sort of the disguises going on all the time, but in a maybe a less organized this is organized, you know, really just a wild
spectrum.
Yeah. You know, just wild to discuss it, you know, all these things. Right?
This is for people who want to know the nature. This is for people who want to know the nature of their mind.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is why we meditate. This is why we come study and teach.
So whatever the nature of your mind is, then it will help you learn the nature of your mind. So you're saying whatever shape your stomach out of something, Marshall.
But not everyone. Not everyone can be here to work with this. Uh-huh. Not everyone.
That's important. There are people who will not come here or to a place similar to this and sit down long enough to have the possibility of hearing.
Right, if you have severe ADD and can't
or if you don't want to. They're not interested. This is the point of interest. The reason we're all here is because we have a common point of interest. We're discovering that. We might not have known that in advance, but this is what we find out by, you know, sharing this common point of interest, understanding the nature of mind, understanding the nature of ourselves. And as we learn,
beginning to recognize the possibility or the reality of something called real sanity. And this is a term Trungpa Rinpoche used extensively, particularly in the early stages of his teachings, of sanity. It's just being basic sanity. That's what we want with our practice. So that's what we're looking for. If we're not interested in that, we won't be here. We got in here. Oops, sorry. Wrong place. See you later.
Okay, Sanders.
Yeah, I heard another teacher talking about it in terms of that there's the relative world and there's the absolute, and that it's very important to remember we live in the relative world and we will continue to live in the relative world, whatever level, you know, that's how we are constituted. It's more like seeing a little bit what's behind the curtain, but the idea is not that in some way the world, everyday world, is unreal and we should reject it.
Right.
I think I think that's you know, sometimes people say, you know, the idea that, you know, if you get glimpses beyond, you say, well, that's the real stuff, and they're both part of reality. I think of that as the message. I don't know if that aligns with the explanation.
That's very good, and we are all self-selected because we're here, and we all belong here.
Thank you.